Well, I'm going to get into these. Why don't we let's postpone some of these discussions till after we've gone over some of the basics. Okay, so the point of this talk is going to be to try to persuade you that this common wisdom is mistaken. It's not true. If you define evolution properly, it is always described by a complete positive map, and therefore there is not an interesting problem here for the research and quantum information processing, and there is no foundational significance to these non-CP maps that people have studied. Okay, so there's diversity in the literature, but when you look at all the literature, as David has done exhaustively, there's a kind of a pattern that emerges. So I'm going to try to give you essentially the flavor of the argument of how people come to the conclusion of needing non-CP maps. So this is the sort of the starting idea of what I'll call the standard argument for how you ought to define the evolution map. So the starting idea is this. If you have a circuit that looks like this, right? So now I'm going to call the version of the system before and after S1 and S2, because we're always talking about maps, dynamics from S1 to S2. So that's going to be a sort of useful convenience. You can work out what the reduced state on S1 is. That's just the trace over E of the initial correlated state that you've prepared. And you can work out the reduced state on S2, and that, of course, is just take your initial state, evolve it according to the unitary, and then trace over the environment here. And then you take that pair of states and you grant that whatever map describes the dynamics, it should take the initial state to the final state. Okay, so the standard argument presumes, at the very least, that the input state calculated in this way should be mapped to the output state by the map that describes the dynamics. Okay. But the problem is that if you just took this as a kind of definition, it doesn't really constrain the map at all, because I just have a single pair, a single input state, a single output state constraining this map, and there are many, many maps that will be consistent with a given pair. So, for example, for any pair you give me, the map that, for example, traces and then just reprepares row S2 is consistent with that pair, right? And then there's many others. So this is an extremely weak constraint on the map. It certainly doesn't define a map uniquely. But nonetheless, the standard argument is sort of committed to trying to identify the map in this sort of way, by focusing on input-output pairs of states. And therefore, the move that's made is to say, well, what we need to do to uniquely identify the map is introduce some variation in the input state on S1. So that variation can be done in different ways, and in different articles it's done in different ways, but it could be by virtue of some classical variable that can influence what the state you prepare in S1E is, but it could also be by virtue of measurements you do on the system and the environment and conditioning on the outcome of those measurements. That can induce variation in the state you prepare in S1E, and any combination of those two can also induce variation on the state. So that's the tool that they use to get some variability, and then they just go through that standard idea that for every value of J and K, you get some state on S1 and E. From that state, you can compute the marginal on S1. You can compute how that state gets evolved to S2 in the final version of E, and then compute the marginal on S2. So now you have a set of input-output pairs. You then combine them into a mathematical relation. It's just the set of all such input-output pairs, obviously labeled by J and K. And then you say, all right, the evolution map is the map which has each of these input-output pairs as input and output. And then if you have sort of enough variability, this should uniquely specify a map, at least if you assume that the map's supposed to be linear. Yep?
Just want to try to understand the point you're making. Is the point that if I just give S1, row S1,
yep,
there's many entangled states that could all produce the same marginal row S1, so we don't even know which one to start with.
Not quite. No, the point I'm making is that if somebody starts with a description of a circuit with a very particular correlated state here.
Well, why should they start with a very, why don't they just say start with any row?
Okay, but so the reason I'm starting here is that in some sense this is the best position you could be in the sense you have a complete description of everything that's going on in your circuit. You know what this is, you know what that is. When you say, well, why start with a particular state? To some extent, that's where the proponents of the standard argument get pushed to. They say, ah, no, we must start with a kind of set of initial states, because only then does our prescription for defining a map really work. Yeah.
I mean, I think, yep. I think maybe it's worth having a little more context, which is that there, a imagining that there really is this separation between system and environment. System is the thing that you control. Environment is something you don't control.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an experimentalist, you say, I want to create the state world. And so you do whatever you do to create the state world. But in the process, you're actually creating some kind of state of the environment. You don't necessarily know exactly what that entangled state is.
It's not quite true that all the articles on this topic presume that you can't control the environment state.
Okay.
Many of them do presume, and even in Nielsen and Chuang's example, you have a certain amount of control over the environment state as well. So this is meant to try to, so that we don't have to get into the details of everybody's different approach, this is trying to kind of tell you the spirit of all of them. You know, it's general enough to capture pretty much all these approaches. But it is true that, you know, different people will emphasize why they're doing this. You know, they might justify it in different ways. But this is the basic idea. I'm just telling you sort of mathematically, this is how their prescription looks.
Can you say a little bit more about this K? So the idea that
yep.
you make some measurement, you learn the value of the state that's there?
That's right. So for example, again?
That's like the state that remains after the measurement.
Yeah, it's like the state like for example, you could imagine doing and one of my examples would be like this. You do say a measurement on the system side alone, and for example, if it's a pure state basis, you then collapse system environment to a product state, right? And then based on knowing the outcome, you now say, one of these particular states is actually a product state.
You might also allow a measurement on S learning.
Yep, you could also, I don't know of any articles that have measured E, but you could do that as well, and you get some variation in that. Yep. Okay. So did I go through this? No. Yes, I did. I went through this. I did. Okay, good. So yeah, the idea is that you get this input-output relation, and with enough variation, you can uniquely fix a map, assuming it's linear. Okay, so here's another way of thinking about it. This cartoon will come back later, but you know, your input-output relation is a bunch of pairs labeled by the values of J and K, and you're looking for a map that's consistent with all of them. That's the prescription, the standard arguments prescription for the evolution map. All right, now let me just mention that most of those articles consider the following problem. They say, suppose you give me some set of joint states on the system and the environment, then what are the conditions under which the map that's defined is completely positive, no matter what unitary I lay down here? So there's been work on whether, you know, discord being zero is a necessary and sufficient condition for complete positivity, things like that. And they haven't really cared very much about how this variability is induced. So that's going to be one of the things that we do. We're going to talk about, you know, is this K the outcome of a measurement on the system or the environment, and what's the causal structure here? That's going to be important for our analysis, although it's not so important in the literature. And in the end, we're going to conclude that this is not an interesting question. Okay, so let's go through why this prescription that's endorsed by the standard argument has problematic consequences. So first, the motivating example, the failure of complete positivity. Here's a simple case where it occurs. So it's one where you're just doing a measurement on the system. So S and E are two qubits. They're prepared in a maximally entangled state. And now imagine you come along and you do a measurement in a basis. So the two orthogonal elements in the basis are labeled 0 and 1. That's so K is binary. It just labels the outcome of this measurement. But there's a number of different bases you can measure. They're labeled by J. And just imagine that you're doing enough different ones that you're going to have essentially an informationally complete set of states here, so you can characterize things well. And then finally, imagine that it's a von Neumann-Luders update map. So if you get the outcome psi j naught, then you prepare the final state is psi j naught as well. Okay, so if you do that measurement and you think of all of this now as the preparation of a bunch of bipartite states on S1 and E, and let's just focus on the case where the measurements were successful. So we post-select on K being equal to 1. Here are the kinds of states you collapse to. So you get psi J1 as the final state on S1 here. But if you work out what you steer the state of E2, it's the transpose of psi J1. So these are the states that you induce here, labeled by J and K. So now if you ask, well, what's the input-output relation in this case? You have to look at the final unitary, which in this example is very simple. It's just a swap operation. So whatever the state of E was, you swap that into S2. And so remember that E was the transpose of psi J1. So the input-output relation is that for a particular value, J, little j of J and K equal to 1, the input state here is psi J1. The output state here is Psi J1 transpose. This forms an informationally complete set. And so the evolution map is just the transpose. And the transpose is our sort of canonical example of a map that is positive but not completely positive. So this is an example where the evolution map is claimed to be not a completely positive map. In this case, it's a transpose in the computation basis because, yeah. In the computation basis, that's right. Okay, so although this is sort of the motivation for studying these dynamics, I think we already have a problem at this stage. And it comes back to what Jess was saying earlier. You remember, one of the axiomatic justifications for complete positivity is that if I think that I've got some dynamics, you'd expect me to be able to apply it to any subsystem, and I should be able to apply it to half an entangled state. And the only way, therefore, to allow or accommodate these non-CP maps is to say, well, the kinds of states they can be applied to are limited. And so this is a sort of common response that you avoid getting any negative probabilities by saying these sorts of maps can only be applied to certain kinds of bipartite input states, not the full scope of them. And I think that's a problem because if I think so just conceptually about transformations and preparations, these ought to be autonomous processes. Like if I'm doing Newtonian mechanics, the initial conditions and the law of motion are independent. I can imagine, I can ask the question, how would this law of motion evolve this different initial state? So physics is not about describing actual histories. It's about, writing down laws that say, no matter what the initial condition was, here's how it would have evolved. So if you have that notion of an evolution map, there's no good motivation for limiting the scope of things to which it could be applied to. And so I think that's a problem with allowing these non-CP maps as possible descriptions of evolution. But there's going to be much more serious problems, so let's move on. So it turns out that you can construct, using the standard arguments prescription, failures of linearity itself. So here's a simple example. Suppose the system and the environment are prepared in the following way. So they each start out in the zero state, and then I have a classical binary variable J, which applies a controlled Hadamard on the system and a controlled not operation on the environment. And then it gets thrown away. So if J is zero, the system gets prepared in stays in the zero state, because nothing happens here. Similarly for the environment, it stays in the zero state. Whereas if J is one, the system gets mapped to the plus state, and the environment gets mapped to the one state. Right, so those are the two possible initial states of the composite S1E. And then the coupling now is a controlled XH operation, Hadamard followed by not. And so if you ask, all right, well, what happens in the case where J is zero? Well, then the environment is zero, and this doesn't act. So S2 is also going to be in the zero state. But if J is one, then it applies this operation. So it takes the state of S1, which is originally plus. It applies the Hadamard, which takes it back to zero. It applies the not. It ends up as one. So in the J is equal to one case, the final state of S2 is one. In the J is equal to zero, it's zero. The initial states were zero and plus. This is the input-output relation. But you'll notice that the inputs are non-orthogonal. The outputs are orthogonal. There's no linear map that will take, that'll increase the distinguishability of states. And so the only map that's consistent is a nonlinear map. All right, why is that a problem? Well, if you think that evolution is a kind of data processing, then this increase in the distinguishability of states is basically saying that you can process and increase the information content of the signal. And I think that's conceptually very problematic. It's essentially a violation of the data processing inequality. All right, but the most serious problem or pathology of these the standard argument is that sometimes this relation just doesn't define a map at all. So again, a simple example. You start, system and environment are qubits. They start out maximally entangled. Now the variation is induced by just a transformation on the system alone, right? So it doesn't touch the environment at all. And it's just going to be a controlled knot based on the value of this binary variable J. And then system environment are going to couple via a controlled knot from the environment back to the system. So if you ask, well, for the different values of j, what's the bipartite state on system environment? In the first case, j is equal to 0. It's just whatever the initial state was. In the second case, it flips the value of, it applies a controlled knot to S1. So when j is 1, S1 flips. And so I get anti-correlation now between S1 and E. And then if I ask, how do each of these evolve to the final level? Well, this controlled knot, when acting on the first guy, right, this will remain unchanged. The controlled knot from 1 to here will take this to 0. So the final state on S2 will be 0 when j is 0. Whereas here, it's the opposite. This is the case where the controlled knot does nothing. This is the case where the controlled knot flips the system. So the final state on S2 will be 1 in this case. So the input-output relation is going to have 0 and 1 as its final states for the j is equal to 0 and the j is equal to 1 term. But both those terms have the completely mixed state as their input. Because if I ask what's the reduced state on S1 for both these cases, it's always the completely mixed state. So the input-output pairs for j is 0 and j is equal to 1 have the same input and different outputs. That's a well-defined mathematical relation, but it does not define a function. It does not define a map. So it's a many-to-one relation, and it just doesn't define a map at all. So if you bought into the prescription of the standard argument, then you're forced to conclude that in some cases there just isn't any map describing the evolution. And so that, to my mind, should really make you reconsider the idea that this prescription for how you ought to define the evolution map is sensible. Okay. So let me just mention that, you know, although I've given you just a handful of examples, these are kind of have enough variety to represent what's going on in the literature. They're all of this generic form I mentioned earlier, and they differ in terms of whether you're transforming the system alone or the system in the environment or doing measurements on the system, that sort of thing. And although I've shown for different, you know, choices these particular pathologies, in fact, you can fill in this whole chart. So you can get pathologies of every type for every kind of circuit, and we do that in the appendix to the paper. And let me just mention that going forward, the sort of the nature of the pathology is not going to be important for us, but these kinds of distinctions are going to be important for our analysis. Okay, so again, you know, if you read the literature, the sense that you get is that people look at these failures, like the failure to be CP, as somehow indicative of quantum strangeness, that, you know, evolutions can just sometimes, you know, that's just all part of the weirdness of quantum mechanics. So now I want to persuade you that these pathologies have nothing to do with quantum theory, that all of this stuff ultimately can be seen in classical examples. So I'm going to switch to now analyzing the same sort of thing, but in classical examples. So let me just set up some notation. So the analogs of these quantum states are just going to be classical statistical states. So whereas S1 previously was a label of a quantum system, S1 now is going to be a random variable, a classical random variable that takes one of several values, and P of S1 is just some distribution on that variable. The analog of a completely positive map now is going to be a stochastic map. So if it's from S1 to S2, I write it as gamma S2 given S1. And it's just, if you take a particular distribution over S1, the stochastic map is induced by some conditional probability. You can think of this as a definition of a stochastic map. Okay, so I'm not saying this is the correct analog of complete positivity, but it's certainly an analog, and it's the one that's going to be relevant here. And now let me just mention a few things so we don't get confused about notation. So when I write P capital A of little a, I really mean the probability that the variable capital A takes this value. Most of the time, I'm just going to be referring to the probability distribution itself, and I'm not going to evaluate it at any value. And then also, my notation is going to be such that, like, when I write sum over capital A of some joint distribution, I really mean it's a function over A and B such that has these values, where I've summed over all the values of A. And similarly, this tensor product notation is just the function now on A and B, which has these values, and this is the function on A and B, which is induced by this identity. And then finally, this I'm going to make a fair bit of use of, kind of in analogy with the quantum notation. When I write something like square bracket little a, that's a point distribution, right? So it's a distribution on the variable a that has all its weight on the value little a. And similarly, for pairs of systems, when I write down something like this or this, I mean a point distribution on that pair of values.
Is there a reason you're not using a delta function?
This makes it look a little bit more like Ketz, and it's easier to write down the equations, that's all. So for example, if I had a stochastic map that took me from a point distribution on the classical state 2 to a uniform distribution over 1 and 2, that would be written in this kind of way. So it looks kind of like quantum states at a diagonal. I should say, you know, all of these classical examples, are quantum examples, just where all the density operators are diagonal and all the maps keep you in that basis. All right, so now let's go back to the standard argument, but now we're in this classical setting. So it's exactly the same. We're going to now, instead of a unitary here, we're just going to have some deterministic function that sets the values of S2 and E given the values of the systems at the inputs. We're going to have some distribution over S1 and E that varies with J and K. And we have a whole set of those. We can compute the marginal distribution on S1 by just summing over E. We can compute the final marginal distribution on S2. Using that function. We can define an input-output relation, and the idea of the standard argument here would be that the map that describes the evolution in this classical case where I have some system-environment correlation initially ought to take all these input states to the corresponding output state. So that would just be the classical version of the prescription we saw earlier. And so here it is in cartoon form. You've got all these input-output states, and you should find a unique map that does it all. So again, you can generate examples exactly of the sort I gave you before of these various different forms, and you get exactly the same kinds of pathology. So let me show you a failure of stochasticity, the analog of a failure of complete positivity. So the idea is, again, you start out with correlated systems. So now S1 and E are going to be four-valued classical variables, starting out in this perfectly classically correlated state. And then this measurement I do here is going to ask the question of S1, is it in the state 2 or 3 or not, right? And K is just a binary output that tells you, was it in the state 2, 3 or not? But depending on J is a three-valued variable, which tells you which measurement you're doing. Either you're asking, is it 2, 3 or not? Or you might be asking, is it 1 or 3 or not? Or 1 or 2? And then critically, at the end, you re-prepare the S1 over the complementary set of values. So for example, if you did the 2, 3 versus not measurement and you got the 2, 3 outcome, then you re-prepare S1 in the 0 or 1 state with uniform probability. Okay, so first of all, what are, for the different values of J and K, what are the joint states on S1E? I'm going to again focus on post-selecting on K equal to 1, getting the successful outcome. Well, it's just going to be 2 or 3 for the environment, right? Because the environment was perfectly correlated with the system. I found out that the system was 2 or 3, so the environment's 2 or 3 as well. And similarly for the other cases. And now the system just gets prepared in the complementary state. So the complement of 2 or 3 is 0 or 1. The complement of 1 or 3 is 0 or 2, and so on. So these are the product distributions that get prepared. And then if I ask, well, what's the output at S2? This is, again, just a swap gate. So the output at S2 is just going to be whatever the distribution on E was. So the input-output relation is just these various distributions, and the outputs is the complement of those distributions. And it's not hard to show that this defines a linear map, but it's not a stochastic map. And one way to see it is if I think of these three distributions here as encoding the value of a trit, I could just draw it as these three sausages. Right, so it's one of these three uniform distributions. And the three output distributions are a different kind of encoding of a trit. But there's no stochastic map that could take you from this encoding to this encoding, because here there's a chance that the state has no information about the value of the trit. This guy's consistent with all three. Whereas here, none of them are consistent with all three. So you have a less ambiguous coding here than you do there. There's no stochastic map that's going to do that for you. It's basically increasing the information content. Okay, so as you see, it's very similar to the quantum example, but it's totally classical. You can get a failure of linearity, again, with an analog of our quantum example. So these now are, this is a three-valued variable, this is a binary variable. They either start out as zero and zero both, and when j is zero, they stay that way. So that's the first guy. But when j is one, I do these controlled operations. So over here on the left where I used to have a Hadamard, it's a randomization gate, which takes zero to just the uniform distribution over zero and one. And over here on the right on the environment, it's just a controlled knot. So when j is one, I get a uniform distribution on the system and a one on the environment. And then up here, I do, instead of the controlled X Hadamard, I do this shift upwards by one modulo three. So in the first case, where the environment is zero, that the controlled operation doesn't act. In the second case, where the environment's one, it shifts this up by one. So it takes it to the one mixed with two state. So the input-output relation then is zero, zero, or uniform on 0, 1 with the final state 1 or 2. And it's like what we saw in the quantum case. These are overlapping distributions, whereas these are disjoint distributions. So this would increase the distinguishability of these states. And the only way to do that is with a nonlinear map. So again, nothing particularly quantum about that pathology. And then finally, the worst one where you didn't have a map at all was essentially already classical to begin with. Although I drew it with a maximally entangled state, there was nothing about that example that required the entanglement. I could have just depolarized that entangled state. The example would have looked exactly the same. So that's all I've done here. So it's the same thing. I do a controlled knot here, and a controlled knot back there. You get these positive or negative correlations. And what you find is that the reduction for both values of j is completely mixed on S1, but it maps S2 to 0 or 1, depending on the value of j. And so it's a many-to-one relation. Yes?
Does that R, are you giving us the whole map, or are the only allowed starting states 0 plus 1? I mean, is that the complete specification of all the ordered pairs that define the map?
Yes, so in these examples, the way we get variation in the input state on S1 and the output state on S2 is we put it in by hand through some sort of controlled operation like this one. So I'm saying for the example I've generated here, I've achieved only a little bit of variation. I only have a binary J. And so, you know, you could have imagined trying to introduce more variation, but already this tiny little bit of variation leads me into trouble. It defines a relation that is inconsistent with any map. And so I'm just saying if you've endorsed this protocol for sort of, you know, induce variation any way you like, and then find the input and the output states, and then find the map that fits them, you've got a problem. So I want to analyze what the problem was, where it came from. Yeah?
You want to say one too many?
I'm sorry?
You want to say one too many? Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. One too many, yes. Not many to one. Thanks. Okay, so all of the pathologies you saw in the quantum case hold for classical examples. And yet, no one has seen fit to say that, oh, maybe classical evolutions are not described by stochastic maps. Maybe there's some more general way of modeling classical evolution when systems and environments are initially correlated. So why is that, that we didn't see that happening in the classical sphere? And I think the answer is that, essentially, in the classical sphere, nobody ever endorsed this prescription I told you about, the standard argument for how you ought to define an evolution map. But people did think about these kinds of examples, these situations where systems and environments are initially correlated. And it's part of the field of causal inference and causal modeling. And, you know, people think about it a lot in the context of things like Simpson's paradox and correlation versus causation. So we're going to re-examine those classical examples from the perspective of that framework where we know how to solve all these problems. So this is the framework of classical causal models and something called the Dew calculus, which you can read about in Judea Pearl's book on causality. I'll just give you the bare bones of it. Suppose I have a causal model, which means I have a directed acyclic graph together with some conditional probabilities that supplement the graph. So here I'm imagining something like a situation where you have some treatment, like say a drug, which might influence recovery for some condition. But also you have a variable gender, which can act as a common cause on treatment and recovery, because maybe men prefer to take the treatment and they also tend to recover from this condition more than women do, right? So this is sort of a kind of situation which would make interpretation of your drug trial a bit problematic. But suppose you've specified, you're just imagining this as a theoretical construct, you specify the conditional probability of recovery given the treatment and the gender, you specify the probability of treatment given gender, and you specify the distribution over the genders. These are the parameters of your model. Then you can compute something like the conditional probability of recovery given treatment. And that's just a formula from classical probability theory. It just says, find the probability of recovery given treatment and gender times the probability of gender given treatment, sum over gender, that'll give you the conditional you're interested in. But here's the key thing. The way you ought to interpret this conditional is not the causal effectiveness of the treatment on the recovery. Because the right way of thinking about standard conditionals is, what does observing the treatment variable teach me about the recovery variable? Right? So in a circumstance wherein men were more likely to seek treatment and more likely to recover, I could imagine a positive correlation between recovery and treatment. Meaning, if you tell me there's a member of population and they took the drug, then I can infer they're more likely to have recovered. But the reason that the treatment acts as evidence for recovery is because of the common cause. That, oh, the fact that they took treatment teaches me they're more likely to be a man. The fact they were a man means they're more likely to have recovered, and that's why I update my beliefs in them recovering. And it says nothing about whether the treatment causes recovery. In fact, there might even be no causal influence at all, and yet I still have this positive correlation. So a standard conditional probability should not be interpreted as the causal influence of one variable on the other. The way to figure out what the causal influence is different. It's you should imagine doing a randomized drug trial. So if I'd done a randomized drug trial, then I would have said, well, it doesn't matter what treatment the subject prefers, you know, so whether you're a man or a woman, you prefer one treatment, it doesn't matter. I'm going to flip a coin and administer a placebo or the drug. You're going to get the assigned treatment. It's statistically independent of any of your preferences. Therefore, there can't be a common cause between it and recovery. And so any correlation I see now can testify to the effectiveness of the treatment, any positive correlation. But the point is that even if I haven't done the randomized trial, if you ask, can I compute the causal effectiveness of treatment or recovery from the parameters of the actual model, right? The things that are specified over here. The answer comes back, yes. So this is called the do conditional. And it just says, look, what would we have seen over here? So the idea is that the counterfactual we're imagining is everything in the world is the same. So in particular, the way recovery depends on treatment and gender is the same over here in this counterfactual world. The way gender is distributed is the same in this counterfactual world. The only thing that's changed is how a treatment is influenced by gender. We replaced the natural treatment preference conditioned on gender with a new thing, which just says, no, the treatment's going to be assigned at random. So that's the only part that's changed. But if I compute over here what the probability of recovery given the assigned treatment is, it comes out to be this formula. And it's just the probability of recovery given treatment and gender times the distribution over gender summed over the genders. And these parameters are here in the model in the real world. This doesn't depend on T given G at all. So if I have this model, I can compute the do conditional. So the point is this. If you give me this model with these parameters, I can compute two things. One is what treatment teaches me about recovery. The other is what forcing the treatment to be, say, drug or placebo does, how it influences recovery. You know, how will the distribution over recovery change as I make different interventions on treatment? Both can be computed just given what you know about your model. You don't need to do the randomized trial. Okay, here's just a small nuance. If I reframe these as maps, which is what we've been talking about so far, so there's a stochastic map which is induced by the standard conditional. So it's just the map that takes a distribution over T and it multiplies it by the conditional and sums over T, where this is the formula I gave you on the previous slide. And then there's a do map, which is the same thing. It's just induced by the do conditional.
Sorry.
Yes?
I just got to take us back. What is, obviously, in the real world, we do randomized control trials.
Yeah.
Is it that you don't know all those parameters in the real world?
Well, this is one of the insights of Perl's. Let's say I did an experiment and I got a joint distribution over gender, treatment, and recovery. PRTG. I can then compute each of these using formulas from classical probability theory. And then Perl says, take those things you've computed, plug them into this equation. That will tell you the effectiveness of the treatment on recovery. Do not do what you might naively want to do, which is just compute this thing, because that won't tell you the effectiveness of treatment on recovery. You just have to be more clever.
So where is the magic happening? It's that we assume we know the puzzle model, or we assume in real life we have to do RCT.
No, you're right. But if you didn't know that this was the causal model, you couldn't do this trick. So if you know that this is what's going on,
the key assumption is that the gender is the only other thing that's important.
That's right. That's right. If you thought there might be something else and you haven't conditioned on it. So strictly speaking, to calculate the Duke conditional, you need to go and condition on anything that can act as a common cause of these two guys. And if you're missing something, then you can't compute it. Yeah. Okay, so I can rewrite this as maps, and now note that there's a difference between just the inference map and what I'll call the do map. And now if I bring it back to our circuit examples, there are two maps that you might reconstruct. One is the inference map. What does learning S1 teach you about S2? The other is this evolution map, or do map. What does intervening on S1 teach you about S2? So the idea of this evolution map is it really answers the question of in, you know, a counterfactual world where you went in and you suspended how S1 depends on its parents in the natural course of events and replaced it with some new preparation of S1, some new distribution of S1, and you ask, how would that evolve? What distribution over S2 would I get in such a world? That's given by this map. And so the claim is, that's what evolution is. Evolution is the ability to make inferences no matter what the state is. So, you know, Newton's laws tell me what the evolution will be no matter what the initial conditions are. They don't tell me what the trajectory is for a particular initial condition. Similarly, these evolution maps tell you what you can infer about S2 regardless of what you do to S1. Yes?
Why doesn't this end up with now a product state? I mean, because you threw away...
It does. So, yes, because so over here I had so the standard conditional, what is S1 teaching me about S2, was given in terms of what S1 and E teaches me about S2 and what S1 teaches me about E. Whereas over here, S1 can't teach me about E because I've intervened, right? So, and so it's just what's the distribution over E, which is basically the marginal distribution on E for whatever your initial distribution was. That's right. So you're effectively eliminating that initial correlation through this definition. But remember, this is not the circuit you're interested in. This is the counterfactual circuit you're imagining to think about this definition. But this definition, everything that appears in it, is a parameter in this model. So for example, the probability of S2 given S1e is just computed by taking the deterministic function of S2 in the environment given its parents and then marginalizing over the environment, right? So that's defined through this circuit, and this is presumed to be given in the circuit, so I can compute P of E. So these are all things I can compute given a description of the circuit. All right. Okay, so now let's revisit the standard argument and see where all those pathologies came from. So there's actually two mistaken assumptions in the standard argument. The first one is basically conflating the evolution map with the inference map. You know, remember the starting idea of the standard argument, which I'll now bring over to the classical context. It was that, you know, if I compute the marginal on S1 and the marginal on S2, and I look at a particular, the single input-output pair, then certainly they form a constraint on the evolution map, that map should take the input distribution to the output distribution. But if you ask how are these two distributions related according to classical probability theory, well, they're just related by the conditional probability. And therefore, the map that connects them is the inference map, because this is not the do conditional, this is the regular conditional. So input-output pairs are related by the inference map, not the evolution map. And so the starting point of the standard argument, the one constraint that it says that this is going to be a constraint on evolution map, is in fact only a constraint on the inference map, not a constraint on the evolution map. And so this mistake of the standard argument is like confusing correlation with causation. It's like the people who look at drug trials, they compute the regular conditional probability, they say, oh, the treatment's effective for recovery, but they're wrong because all that's happening is that there's a common cause and the treatment is informing you about recovery. So it's the same thing here, that the first step is basically constraining a totally different kind of map, which is the inference map, not the evolution map. But that doesn't explain the pathologies, because if at the end of the day, the standard argument had just said, oh, let's reconstruct this map, and they'd been wrong, and they were reconstructing the inference map. All those inference maps are still stochastic maps. They're all induced by conditional probabilities. So we wouldn't have seen this failure of stochasticity, linearity, failure to define a map. So there's a second mistake, which is that that variation that was introduced into the input state actually induced variation in the inference map itself. Let me tell you what I mean by that. So remember the definitions of the inference and the evolution map. I've been emphasizing that you can get all of these parameters from a description of your circuit. And therefore, once you've sort of figured out that there's these maps to reconstruct, you don't need to put any variation in the input state, right? If you give me this, I can go and compute these things. I don't need to induce artificially any variation here. If I have a full description of the circuit, I can compute these things. So there was no need to vary the input state to begin with, but this was sort of missed in the standard argument, and they induced this variation, and that was sort of the problem, because the whole act of inducing the variation ultimately is what leads to the pathologies in the following sense. All right, so suppose I put the variation in, I allow a j and a k, and then I just ask, again, from the perspective of classical probability theory, what formula should relate my conditional S1 given jk to my conditional S2 given jk? So this is just a calculation in probability theory. So this is the definition of S2 given JK. It's the joint over S2, S1, and E given JK, where I marginalize over S1 and E. And then I just expand this just using conditional probability. So this joint given JK is can be written as S2 given S1 and E, E given S1, S1, with JK on the right everywhere. I then use the fact that if I ask, what do S1, E, J, and K teach me about S2? That's this guy here. Well, actually, whatever the four teach me about S2, S1 and E alone teach me the same thing about S2. So S1 and E screen off J and K from S2 because J and K don't have any direct causal connection to S2. It's always through S1 and E. So I can simplify this to just S2 given S1 and E, and I plug that back in. All right, we're almost done. So this is the formula that relates this conditional and this conditional. Let me put it at the top of the slide. And here's the punchline. If I now just rewrite this as a kind of labeled probability distribution, labeled by values j and k, this formula here, this whole thing here, defines a map. So I've just written out the definition here. And the point is that this map depends on the values of j and k. Right? So it isn't defining a jk independent map. It's defining a map that varies as I vary the input and output states as well. Okay, so this is just what classical probability theory tells you. So the inference map, that's what this thing is. It says, what can I infer about S2 from S1 if I know the values of J and K? That changes as I change the values of J and K. And so the point is this, that the different components of this input-output relation are all related by different inference maps. So this is an input and output of this inference map. And this is an input and output of another inference map, but they're different inference maps. The inference maps that are appropriate for other values of J and K. And what the standard argument had us do is assume that all of these were inputs and outputs of a single map. And there's nothing here that justifies that. Okay? In general, they won't be. And if you presume that they are, you get all these crazy things. If I go back to example 3, the inference maps for j is equal to 0 and j is equal to 1 were as follows. No matter what you believe about S1, when j is 0, you should believe that S2 is definitely going to be 0. Why? Because when j is 0, these guys are positively correlated. This control knot here, it just makes S2 equal to the sum of S1 and E. And so it just tracks this parity. So if j is 0, this parity is 0, so S2 comes out as 0, definitely. If j is 1, this parity is 1, so S2 comes out as 1, definitely. So it says it doesn't matter what you believe about S1, you should believe that S2 is 0 if j is 0, you should believe S2 is 1 if j is 1. Those are the two inference maps. And sure enough, the first inference map is validly constrained by this input-output pair, and the second one certainly is consistent with this input-output pair, but nothing is consistent with both together, because that would be a one-to-many map, and there's no such thing. Okay, now in this example, if I ask what's the actual evolution map from S1 to S2, the prescription tells me to imagine intervening on S1 and computing just what's the marginal on E, which in this case is a uniform distribution, and then it does a controlled knot operation over here, But because it's either 0 or 1, it either has identity or not with equal likelihood. So it's always going to prepare a uniform distribution on S2, no matter what the input to S1 is. So this is the evolution map in that example. Just always prepare this uniform distribution. It doesn't depend on J. And that's pretty clear because here J only influences the system. It doesn't influence the environment. And this evolution map depends only on the marginal state of the environment. Okay, so in this example, you know, the inference maps have nothing to do with the evolution map. The standard argument was only putting constraints on inference maps, and it was combining all those constraints and trying to get one map and getting something crazy, but this is really what you want. Classical example 2 looks kind of similar. You can work out what the inference map is for a particular value of this binary variable J, and it just tells you that whatever you believe about S1, you should believe the same thing about S2, possibly shifted upwards by 1 if J is 1 and not shifted upwards if J is 0. So that's just this map here. And sure enough, it does describe the input output, like the J is equal to 0 version describes this input output pair. The J is equal to 1 version describes this input output pair. No linear map is consistent with both. Okay, and in this particular example, the evolution map and the inference maps, they're both J-dependent, and they happen to coincide. That's not generically true. But here it's true because when I condition on J, there is no correlation left between the system and environment. So they really are. So the system can't teach me anything about S2 except via this cause-effect relation. It can't teach me anything via the other relation. All right, so if you just ask, you know, when is it that this starting point of the standard argument, focusing on input-output pairs, when does that actually constrain the evolution map, not just the inference map? Well, that's when these two things happen to coincide, and they'll coincide if S1 teaches you nothing about E, because then this conditional reduces to this conditional. So that's the constraint for when they'll coincide, which, according to classical probability theory, is just the same as this. So precisely when the system and environment are not correlated initially, that's when you expect that these input-output pairs should tell you something about the evolution map. And that's precisely not the situation that motivates this whole field. It's the case where they are correlated. So the standard argument is fundamentally sick. Okay, so let me just get back to the quantum case and end. So here's the point, that because these classical statistical states and stochastic maps are actually special cases of quantum states and CP maps, where everything's diagonal on some basis, all these mistakes I just described for you are mistakes in the quantum context as well. You can't believe the standard argument in the quantum context as well, because it just doesn't work for the reasons we've seen. But you might say, well, you know, I've shown you how to solve the problem, how to define the correct evolution map in the classical sub-theory of quantum theory, but how do I do it more generally when I've got an example that's intrinsically quantum? And it's pretty straightforward to see what the quantum analog of Pearl's due conditional is. So let's just remember what the classical evolution map was. And I've changed notation slightly here to facilitate the comparison with quantum. So I've put in this functional dependence. I've now specified that the final environment variable is E prime, and this functional dependence is a map from S1E to S2E prime. And so the due conditional is just take the marginal on E with whatever distribution on S1 you're interested in, apply this deterministic map, and then marginalize over E prime. That will give you the due conditional rather than the standard conditional, because there's no conditioning on S1 here. It's just the marginal distribution on E. And so all these things have quantum analogs, right? So instead of this deterministic function here, I just have a unitary superoperator that takes S1E to S2E prime. And I have, instead of a joint distribution, my joint state. So it's just, you know, imagine the counterfactual scenario wherein instead of the quantum system S1 having been determined by the actual preparation, somebody has intervened and prepared it in whatever state they like. What would you assign as a quantum state for S2 in that case? And the answer, of course, is just, well, take the marginal on E, rho E, with whatever distribution you've prepared on S1, apply the unitary here, trace over E prime. That's what you should assign as your final state for S2. And then these parameters are parameters that, of course, exist in the actual model. So if you give me a description of your circuit and you ask, what is the evolution map from S1 and S2? The answer is this thing. not what the standard argument would say. Okay, and note that because I've now eliminated the correlation between the system and the environment, this is always completely positive because it's of the Stein-Spring form. Okay, in the classical case, we had this other map, the inference map. What does S1 teach me about S2? So a natural question is there something like an inference map in quantum theory? Could it be that the standard argument, if you hadn't inadvertently introduced variation, could somehow give you a constraint on the inference map? That's an interesting question. The answer is, I've tried for many years to come up with a good definition of a quantum inference map. Here are some papers that try to do that, and so far it's inconclusive. I would say that probably there are some limited situations in which it makes sense to talk about a quantum inference map, but in general there isn't an analog of that classical concept. We can talk more about that later if you want. If you ask the question, like I did in the classical case, when does a single input-output pair of state on S1 and state on S2 actually constrain the evolution map as we've defined it, this map here, well, remember what the input and output pairs were, right? Just the marginals on these guys. They look like this. If you ask, when is it the case that rho S2, the output, is this quantum evolution map of rho S1, well, the definition of that guy is this here. And so if it's going to be true for all these unitaries, then rho S1 is just going to have to be rho S1 tensor rho E. So it's the same as in the classical situation, which the only place that even a single input-output pair constrains the evolution map is precisely the case where the system and the environment are not initially correlated. That's the one place where you're not going to make that mistake. So in general, the standard argument will tell you nothing about the evolution map. Okay, that's it. So let me just summarize. So I've argued that the correct definition of a quantum evolution map is basically the quantum analog of Pearl's notion of a due conditional from causal modeling, and it's always completely positive. That if you look at the standard argument for how you should define an evolution map when you have these initial system-environment correlations, you find that it's made two distinct mistakes, which are most easily stated in the classical sub-theory of quantum theory. So the types of constraints it appeals to are actually constraints on an inference map rather than the evolution map. But furthermore, it was sort of mistakenly motivated to try to introduce by hand variability in the input state. And that inadvertently introduced variability in the inference map itself. And then it sought to fit a single map to the input-output pairs for all these different maps. And it was that attempt that ultimately led to all the pathological results. All those questions we had in the beginning, like what does this mean for, what does non-CP maps mean for information processing, and what do they mean for axiomatizations of quantum theory? Those are not interesting, but there are some new interesting questions, like is there a sensible notion of an inference map in quantum theory? What are the quantum analogs of other concepts and techniques that you'll find from this causal modeling literature beyond these due conditionals that I've told you about? If instead of having a complete description of the circuit, maybe you just want to go to the lab and you want to sort of figure out what the circuit is, but in particular you want to know what's the quantum evolution map, what sorts of experimental schemes will recover the quantum evolution map, particularly if you fail to have good control, like you're maybe not sure whether you're only accessing the system or whether you're inadvertently accessing the environment as well. It's a different question from the one I've considered here, but I think it's an interesting one. And once you've sort of gotten straight on what the quantum evolution map, I think it can be tackled. And that's the end. Thanks.
So, forgetting about this question about limited experimental control.
Yep.
Suppose you can take whatever measurements along the environment. Is there some analog of this formula that lets you calculate the classical due conditional based on the kind of observable?
There's two ways you can, there's two kinds of problems you can imagine for which, the target is the due conditional. You could say, suppose all I have is access to the two variables I'm interested in, like A and B, I want to know the due conditional from A to B. And furthermore, I know what all the common causes are, and I can go and condition on them as well, and I can get the joint distribution over all those variables. So then Perl has said, okay, if you've done all that, here's the formula, and you can compute the due conditional of B given A. But another scenario might be, no, you don't have access to those common causes. They're like not accessible to you or something. What can you do then? And then typically the thing is, well, then you have to do a randomized trial. So instead of just measuring A and B passively, you say, no, I'm going to take A, and whatever determined it, I'm going to replace that with a new thing which sets its value, and then I'm going to look at the value of B. So that, you know, when you haven't got access to those common causes, then you just you do the actual intervention. Now, in the classical context, people didn't really worry about the idea that, oh, but maybe you can't do focused interventions on A. Maybe you're always inadvertently influencing other things. That's a concern in quantum experiments where people wonder about how well they can actually access a given system. But, you know, in a drug trial, nobody worries about that.
But, yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, okay, so doing this in practice is obviously harder, but supposing you have a system where you have kind of a good idea what the environment is that you're interacting with, and maybe you can even make measurements on the environment. Can you use that to do something analogous, where you can deduce, you know, kind of break down your two-step process?
Well, I think I see what you're saying. So Perl's formula, strictly speaking, was about going and conditioning on common causes, but a perfectly good proxy for the common cause would be some child of the common cause, like the environment degrees of freedom, which acts as the transit. So you can also use Perl's formula by... That's right. Like when I went from the drug trial to my circuit example, we went from gender, which was a common cause, to E, which is a kind of child of a common cause, which is buried in that bottom box. So yeah, you can use Perl's formula using those sorts of proxies to the common cause. But you, again, you need a full set, right? So if there were some common causes that you left out and you didn't have proxies of them, you would get the wrong results. But yeah, you're right that...
But in the quantum case, can you do that? What do you do?
If you go to the definition of the quantum evolution map, the definition depends on the state of the environment and the cup.
But it also depends on this U.
Right.
The cup on...
Suppose I don't know you, I'm having to figure out all of you. That's fine, but I want to figure out, you know, the kind of the CP, the due conditional map that's corresponding to you. That's my goal.
The naive way that you kind of don't want to do would be just, just do standard tomography on all the components of the circuit and then plug it in. Like that would be the stupid way because you're doing more work than you have to. But what you can do, right?
It's worse than that. That's what people do, and this is one of the reasons why they start to bring in these non-CP map, because all the state preparations in the system that you can do create these entangled states with the environment, and that's where you get the situation.
Yep.
So the point is, you don't have complete control over those initial states. They're kind of given to you. But maybe suppose you know what they are. You don't have the ability not to create them. Something
right.
Like that. I mean, even making kind of unrealistic assumptions about your capabilities, provided you don't know what U is and you don't have the ability to just create arbitrary types of product states, what can you do?
So, okay, I think I understand your question. That I would slot this into that final question, which is how do you experimentally determine what the parameters of the circuit are? So I think the right tool for the job is what I would call bootstrap tomography. So normal tomography schemes, like, for example, state tomography, you imagine that you have your measurements well characterized, and then relative to that characterization, you reduce your uncertainty about the states. And then there's something called measurement tomography where you do the opposite. You imagine you have your states well characterized and you figure out what the measurements are. Bootstrap tomography, you start off not presuming that you have either well characterized, and you try to do a self-consistent fit. And so if you do bootstrap tomography and you allow as a parameter in your fit the possibility, you know, one, that these are preparations and measurements on a qubit alone. Two, there are preparations and measurements on a qubit and a qubit environment of that qubit. Three, you know, there's a bigger environment. Like, these are all hypotheses I could bring, and I could look at the quality of the fit. And if I find that the case of assuming it's just all in a single qubit is a poor fit, then I learn, oh, well, it looks like I've inadvertently coupled to my environment because I can't fit it unless I assume that. And so that's how I would sort of diagnose the fact that your interventions, your preparations were not on the system.
This is way more complicated than possible
case. Sure.
What you have to do in the possible.
Yes.
In the classical phase, you assume you can randomize that. So if you assume
I'm saying in the case where you know what the external variable, what the common cause is, but you can't separate it, you don't have to do the randomized product, right? That's
okay, but you have to know what this U is.
No. In the classical case, you don't know what the U is, right? You don't know what the causal link
right.
is between the treatment and the recovery, right? You don't know how the evolution
but
is.
So
you just have the observation of these kind of joint reasons.
David, did you want to say something? All right. No. So I think I take back my answer that I think you can do the right tool. There's a certain version of the classical problem where the right solution is to do a kind of bootstrap tomography. So the formula that you'll find in Pearl's book presumes that you at least know the causal structure. So for example, you know that there's this one degree of freedom in the environment that acts that mediates the common cause. Right. But it presumes that you know that you can just go and measure that one as opposed to measuring that one and having to measure that one as well. If you have uncertainty about that, so if you don't even know the scope of the environmental degrees of freedom to which you're coupling in a classical context, then you'd have to do a kind of bootstrap tomography. And you'd say, well, what's the quality of the fit under the assumption that it's just coupling to this part of the environment? What's the quality? And so I think it's very parallel to what you do in the quantum case.
But suppose I am pretty confident, or at least I will retroactively find out that it's only coupling to this part of the environment.
Okay.
Is there something that's analogous to Pearl's formula that you can make some simple set of measurements and figure out what's going on or not? Let me say what I seems to be the big difference.
Okay.
Here, which is that classically you could using this picture. Classically, I'd say, okay, I'm going to measure, after the initial state preparation, I'm going to measure the environment and find out what state it is.
Like do tomography on the marginal state of the environment. Is that what you mean?
No. In each trial,
yeah.
I'll do a bunch of trials of different states. And each trial, I'm going to measure E, same state multiple times in different state. Each time I do that, I measure E in the intermediate state, find out what it is. And that's how I get this, what are your variables? P... G, E, and G.
You want
G, R, and G, E, and R.
You want the drug trial? Let me pull it up. Here we go.
Yeah. So to know these, I just need the joint probability between P of R, T, and G.
Yeah.
And then I can calculate all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was a classical system,
right.
Go back to the other picture. You can find that out by measuring the environment in the intermediate state.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you also have to measure the system in the intermediate state.
Well,
and then measure the outcome of the system. Right? But in the quantum case, obviously measuring in the intermediate stage is going to change the results.
Let me say something that might be helpful for this discussion. Tell me if it isn't. One of the obstacles to the project of define a quantum inference map is that it's not at all obvious what the correct quantum analog of the joint distribution over R, T, and G is.
Right.
Because we typically don't write down a joint operator on variables, some of which are cause-effect separated and some of which are common cause separated. So that's part of what we've been trying to do. And there's big obstacles. Now, if you could do that, then it might be clear what the right analogies are and how to make sense of it. But I don't know if that helps. I don't think it's obvious. Like, even if I have lots of different points of intervention, it's still not always clear how to define the objects you're interested in.
Well, I think the question that I'm asking is perfectly sensible and well defined. It's not clear what the things you would need to measure to do that.
Yeah. Well, there is a kind of version. Your question sounds a lot like a research problem that David and I have been working on. So I have, in some other work, a notion of a quantum common cause. So you can define this. Reichenbach has this principle that if I condition on a complete common cause of two variables, they become independent. So you can ask a similar thing in the quantum context, like, you know, for what sorts of channels that have one input and two outputs, is it appropriate to say that the input of that channel is the complete common cause of its two outputs? And it's not a straightforward condition. It ultimately boils down to the Hilbert space of the input, not just factoring into two pieces, but being able to write it as a direct sum of pieces that factor, and then, you know, the left factor and the right factor go off. So there's kind of which sector you're in is like a classical degree of freedom, which gets copied and sent to both sides. But, you know, which factor space you're in any given sector is like a quantum degree of freedom that goes off to each. So it's like the constraint for strong subadditivity. Anyway, so that's a notion of a quantum common cause. And the question might be something like, if I can go into that, say I have the system, which is the complete quantum common cause, what kinds of measurements suffice on that system to allow me to compute the quantum Duke conditional? And I'm not 100% sure. I've got some ideas for how to do that. But you kind of get the flavor that every time you ask one of these questions, it always presumes that you know what the right quantum analog of something is. In this case, it's what's the right quantum analog of the complete common cause of two variables. So you have to answer that question first before you can even pose the question you're interested in. No?
Much clearer. I mean, if we go back to the classical case, you said that we can compute this due conditional using such a formula.
Yep, there.
And everything that enters into it is a real world.
Right.
Thing. And yep. I think the question is that statement true, or to what extent is that statement true in the quantum?
Sure. It is also true.
The only real world thing properly defined.
Yep.
Can we compute this due condition, even if we can't compute the other?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the formula for
the
evolution map.
That does not mean we know what the operator U is.
Well,
because
so...
Because in the classical case, we didn't know what the...
In this talk, we've presumed from the beginning that both in the classical case and in the quantum case, we are given a complete description of the circuit. So there's no ambiguity as to what this gate is and what this joint distribution is. And similarly, in the quantum case, there's no ambiguity about what this is and what this is. It's all a question of definitions, right? So like, if you just look at the literature on non-CP maps.
In the classical case.
Yes?
I don't know what it means. You're given the causal graph or whatever you call it.
But you're also given
and
parameters.
You're not given the
well, okay, so maybe the confusion is that often in causal inference, that's the problem people are interested in, that they don't know the parameters. But that's not what I've been doing in this talk. So here it's a question of definitions. So I'm saying, suppose you have a causal model where you know everything. You know the DAG, you know the parameters. That's on the table. And then you ask yourself, what map represents the causal effect of this variable and that variable? Perl has an answer to that question.
Right.
And so now I was just saying, well, what's the quantum analog of that answer when you have everything known about your quantum circuit? The question that we're now, like Daniel was asking, is really a very different kind of question, which is like, suppose instead that you're in the lab and you don't know what these circuit elements are. And, you know, maybe you could do a lot of work and sort of, you know, figure out tomographically what each one is separately and then plug them into the formula. You know, maybe you could do that. But maybe you just want to save yourself some effort and you're asking whether there's something simpler you could do. Instead of getting all the information about this and all the information about that, what you want is just this piece of information. What's the minimum experimental effort that could just get me this, for instance? That's something that experimentists often like. That, you know, for example, if I want to know if I have prepared entanglement, I could do full tomography on my bipartite state and then plug it into a formula for computing the entanglement. But there are more sophisticated ways where I can just do a witness that tells me if there's entanglement or not. And so there's a similar question here, which is, can I get away with characterizing just, you know, what's the minimal effort I need to expend experimentally to just characterize the Duke conditional? But the you're right that the sort of problem that I usually talk about in causal inference, where I say somebody has got some statistical data, like a joint distribution over drug, recovery, gender, and they want to know what's the causal effect. So they don't know those conditionals. They don't know how treatment depends on, sorry, recovery depends on treatment and gender. They just have this joint distribution. That is not a natural question in the quantum domain, because the analog of that joint distribution is precisely something that we normally don't ever talk about. Like, we don't have operators, like a joint operator on three variables, two of which are cause-effect related. So the, maybe in the future we'll be able to say, ah, here's the right quantum analog of that question. But right now it's unclear how to map the natural classical question that I usually talk about to a quantum question. Okay.
Which is the quantum measure of the
decoherence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That is a potential avenue for generalizing this. Yeah.
Until you've sorted out the question where everything is known, you can't really make progress on the harder question unless it's known. If you went to
it's fine. I mean, I like this definition.
Sure.
It's kind
right.
of.
And so, specifically, for example, I think your question, an example of how you need this to start answering your question, I think if I understood your question right, you're imagining this. There's some known set of states of system environment. So
this is the real situation. You have experimentalists, they say, okay, I pair some states, I make some measurements, I can report the measurement results as a function of the things that I did. But you know, I know that it's not actually the case, and if I look at the data, it's not consistent with the system being totally under my control and doing exactly what I want it to do. It's not perfect, right? But how do I break that down into saying, well, there's some error in the preparation procedure and some error in the measurement procedure, particularly when there's an environment that has numbering. So you said you have to do some sort of bootstrap tomography that I couldn't even tell you how to do that in this context. I know of results about self-testing where you want to check if it's a specific thing, but if it's not that, what happens, I don't know. And I know about, you know, like gate set tomography, where you assume that it is Markovian, and you can figure out, again, lots of stuff like this.
So I was imagining a circumstance wherein you had still independence of preparations and measurements, but a lack of independence of, say, system and environment. So maybe you go to the lab and you think...
They're not really different, right? Because the lack of independence of preparations and measurements can be subsumed into saying that there's an environment that remembers.
I think they are different. So what I'm imagining is that suppose the experimentalist thinks that they're preparing 17 different states of system S, but in fact, because of how they've done the experiment, they're preparing 17 different states of S and E. And then when they think they're doing 32 different measurements on S, in fact, they're doing 32 different joint measurements on S and E. But suppose that, you know, the choice of which of the 17 preparations, that doesn't influence what the measurement is, so that you still have independence of which measurement you're doing and which preparation you're doing. You don't have any correlation there. So if you do bootstrap tomography, where you entertain as a possibility that the states are not on the system S, but on a system SE, and you look at how good of a fit to your data table you get, you can diagnose the fact that it wasn't just on the system. So, but I haven't got any sequence here. So like non-Markovianity would come in maybe if I had like a sequence, but I still think that as long as I have independence at every time slice, I could do bootstrap tomography just by saying, okay, this intermediate thing is a map.
Okay, that's kind of true. So I guess I am kind of implicitly putting on some additional restriction. I mean, it is true that you can do whatever preparation you run, whatever measurement you run. But you see, the immediate problem that you run into when trying to do tomography on the system and environment is that you might not have enough different state preparation and enough different measurements to actually do the full tomography on both systems.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You might have enough
right.
to do it on the system by itself if that were
right.
sufficient.
Right.
But
I mean, you might just...
The environment could be pretty big, right?
Sure. And, you know, one thing that could happen is that you do your bootstrap tomography assuming that it's all just system and you get a very bad fit, a terrible p-value, and you say, well, I guess we're going to have to go back to the lab. Like,
you might get a good fit, but negative eigenvalue, which is what actually happens.
Sure. I'm imagining that when you do this fit, you place as a constraint that I'm only going to allow CP maps, for example. That's a constraint on your fit, and then it all comes down to p-value.
Right.
And if you see a terrible p-value, you say, oh, yeah, if you see a bad fit, then you say, well, let me not say, oh, it must be a non-CP map, some bizarre new kind of evolution. You say, oh, no, it must be that I'm coupling to something else. Let me try a fit, again, under the constraint of CP and positive operators and all that, and let me have a larger system and see if that does better. And even if you haven't got full tomography, I think you can still perhaps get a better quality fit. Because if you don't have full tomography, I think it probably just means you have more leeway in how you fit it, not less. Like if I go to bigger Hilbert space, there's lots of ways of fitting a state that'll do justice to my experimental statistics. The problem will be, how do I narrow it down?
That's right.
Yeah. But I think I can do better on p-values if I use a bigger Hilbert space. Necessarily. I can generate a larger set of data tables.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I'm saying that because it's not tomography, I mean, you could do, forgetting about the environment, right? You could do some sort of partial tomography on a state and say, well, I'll just make a couple of measurements, not enough for full tomography,
right.
and then try to infer something from that.
Right.
And, you know, sure, you can get a really good fit that way, but
sure.
you could do even better by not making any measurements at all. And just
right. No.
Yourself.
Yeah. If you're only doing partial measurements, it's a good diagnosis for having a bad fit, but it's never a good guarantee that you've figured
right.
out what your system is.
Right.
So I'm imagining that if you did like, you know, one qubit and you get a terrible fit, and then you do two qubit with partial tomography and you get a better fit, you might say, well, I'm not confident that I've characterized everything well, but I am confident that this is a good direction for trying to understand what's going on in the experiment, that we're coupling inadvertently
I mean,
to the systems.
I think in practice, people are able to diagnose this, like, this fact that there's some memory in the environment reasonably well. There's a bunch of different things that people do. None of them are going to be 100%.
Well, but hang on, let me push back on that. I mean, my impression reading this literature is that because people are fundamentally confused about very basic notions, I don't trust those techniques.
I don't think the community as a whole is that confused about this.
Okay.
I think that maybe a subset of people that work on this as a research direction might be confused about it. But even those people, I think, if you talk to them, actually, and say, well, actually, of course, you know what's going on is the environment has memory, and so you know how to use a descriptive system. They'll say, yeah, I know that, but I still want to do this, because blah, blah, blah. And certainly there's many people out there that are not confused about this, but work on it. Or work on it in different ways. That I feel confident.
I don't know, Daniel, because, you know, it took to the late 80s, early 90s for people to recognize the right way to analyze the statistics of a drug trial. It took that long, such a basic, to you know, disentangle inference and influence in the classical sphere. I really don't think in the quantum sphere that people figured it out.
So
I'm very skeptical.
I think you have to look at a different segment of literature to see that there's people who...
Right.
At least understand the conceptual issues. I'm not saying that they have an answer for how to do it. In fact, there's very little that people can do that once beyond saying, oh, this is a non-Markovian system. Once they say that, it's like, well, okay, I don't know what to do. So that's why I'm trying to push on you to try to get that.
Yeah.
Can I try to rephrase? Because I think we are asking the same question. The answer you gave was, in the classical case, the real world data, which means, what does that really mean? It means you have the joint probability distribution.
Yep.
And as pointed out, you don't have the quantum mechanics for the reason Daniel said, which is that the measurement of the second variable can influence the third variable, and so on. So another way of asking the question is, what would, at a practical level, what should we do to replace the absence of being able to define the joint probability distribution? What set of measurements would be the right one? Is that sort of...
Yeah, I mean, I'm in some sense, I'm more interested in the practical question.
I'm trying to ask it. What set of measurements is it to do or something that would reproduce the information needed that was given to you by the joint probability distribution? Passively. Or you could have everything without disturbing it.
Well, I think I'm still struggling to understand exactly what the question is, but maybe I'll continue saying things till.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
So, can we just like.
Yes. It's a good idea.
Carry on with the question. Okay.
Yep.
So, thank you, Robert, again.
Okay.
Yes. We can continue.
Okay, good. Thanks. Raphael and I can continue a little bit. Let me just get my bag. There is a direct. I mean, it depends what's given. So if what's given to you is,
so remember we have the circuit S1, S2, and E is here. Okay, so here's my circuit. So classically, the formula is that the map that describes the evolution from S1 to S2. Is, and I'll write it here, E prime, sum over E.